everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 55 of Wheat All About It, or what I've entitled, Hold On Tight, The World According to Peter Zion Continued. If you're coming to this podcast without having listened to episode 54, the first part of Zion's presentation before the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention on November 10th, no worries, you'll be fine. But you will miss some context, so back it up, beep, 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 and listen to episode 54 after you're done here. Information about Zion on the internet describes him in different ways, but really, he is a thinker who combines demographic data and a deep understanding of history with a knack for putting the two together in the context of today's world, then coming up with a version of the future that looks remarkably optimistic for America. In episode 54, Zion sets us up for the payoff here. If you're a wheat farmer from the Pacific Northwest, his vision of Southeast Asia's future demand is a welcome balm for those suffering through the current downturn. Even his take on climate change has a silver lining for the U.S., although his description of Canada's future is troubling to the extreme. But Zion has an even worse prediction. World famine is coming. But it will be good for U.S. farmers.
Famine, continental in scope, it's coming back. Famine is horrible. It's a country killer. It's a culture killer. And it is quite possibly the best case outcome for people in this room. Because not only are you the lowest cost, highest quality producers of grain in the world, the United States Navy is 10 times as powerful as the combined navies of the rest of the planet, and if we want to get a shipment somewhere, it's gonna go. But you can't say that for any of the handful of competitors that are gonna remain. Wheat specifically. The brown are the major exporters, the red are the importers. Here's our three conflict zones. We are looking at the entirety of the former Soviet wheat crop simply going away. I know that the wheat market has not exactly been, how should we say, peppy for the last couple of years. Global famine and complete shortage in your competing countries. You guys have nowhere to go but up. And perhaps shockingly, disturbingly so. Let's talk about some of the specific consumers. Obviously, the Eastern Asian seaboard is a big one for you guys. You need to understand how the Chinese work. They don't have a single large chunk of arable land that's easy to transport around like the United States. Instead, they've got the North China Plain. You guys have all played Risk, right? You know how no one wants to start in East Asia because they can come at you from every direction? That's the North China Plain. No internal barriers whatsoever. It has taken 3,000 years of civil war and ethnic cleansing for it to consolidate into a single ethno-political group that we now know as the Han Chinese. They only completed that process last century. This is the land of the politicos, the nationalists, the militarists. You move into the center, however, it's a whole different world. You've got the Yangtze, one of the world's great rivers, 2,000 miles long. This is where people know the value of a dollar. This is the industrialist, the mercantilist. This is the land of Shanghai. When we think of China as an industrial powerhouse, this is what we're thinking about. And then down south, you got something completely different. Mountainous terrain and the green are the tropics. And the same thing that happens to an American in Nicaragua will happen to a northern Chinaman who moves into southern China. They'll get bit by strange bugs that they never knew existed. They'll start bleeding horrible colors, and then they'll die. It's a disease belt, and only the locals are immune. It has always been the last piece of any Chinese empire to get amalgamated into the rest. Northern militarists, central industrialists and traders, southern secessionists. Now, how do you get all these people to be on the same side? Well, option one is you beat the crap out of anyone who steps out of line. It's a national security state for good reason. Option number two is to bribe the hell out of everybody. What they do is they take all of the citizens' savings, funnel them into the major state banks, and then divvy out loans to anyone who can guarantee high employment levels. Doesn't matter if the product is any good, doesn't matter if the product exists. As long as you're employing people, they are not getting together in large groups and going on long walks together. Politburo tries to avoid that. That's how they got their jobs. But it's become so distorted, it's a threat to the entire system. If you haven't looked at Southeast Asia already, I strongly suggest you do so. Now, you look at the map, and at a glance, you're kind of worried. The green is various versions of tropics, generally hard to develop. Islands, mountains, peninsulas, also very difficult to have any sort of value-added society. But the Southeast Asians have a few advantages. First of all, because the topography is so difficult, they have no history of going to war with each other. This isn't like Northern Europe or Northeast Asia. These people can trade locally without the rubric of a global system. In addition, because the topography is so difficult, the population clusters into those few areas that the government is able to provide reasonable services. It's the most urbanized part of the planet. So you get Ho Chi Minh City, you get Saigon, you get Hanoi, you get Manila, you get Singapore, you get Jakarta, which means you get various stages of the production value chain at high cost of labor, mid cost of labor, and low cost of labor. Let me rephrase that. High skilled, mid skilled, and low skilled, but all of them for the equivalent skill set are below the average global cost of those skill sets because they're crammed together in isolated pockets, in urban pockets. No matter where you are in the world, what does everyone who live in a city have in common? You can't grow your own food. So here you've got a regional supply chain trade system that is going to survive the global breakdown that just needs food. Know anyone that produces any? Best part, it's got legs. Up top, you've got Indonesia, down below, Vietnam. Aside from sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia has the youngest demography in the world. This is going to run for at least another 30 years. Specifically, I anticipate Vietnam and Myanmar to be two of the three fastest growing economies for the next half century. The last one's Mexico. Four big reasons why Mexico is going to have a good long growth run measured in decades. First of all, shale. Not theirs, ours. One of the side effects of the U.S. shale oil industry is we produce a volume of natural gas as a waste product that exceeds the production of all but three countries' purposeful natural gas production. We're putting all of that natural gas into our chemical industry, which means that your fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides are the cheapest in the world. And we're also putting it into our electrical network, which means that our electricity costs have now flatlined for 7 years straight. We're also exporting the surplus to Mexico. The red lines on this map represent the pipes that predate shale. Everything else is new. All of them come online by the end of next year. We will, over the course of the last 6 years, have gone from exporting to Mexico 1 BCF of natural gas to 14. They will be getting over half their electricity because of our natural gas, which means that their blackouts are a thing of the past. Their industrial production is about to expand significantly.
Zion went into some detail about the drug gangs in Mexico, including the consolidation that occurred under the drug kingpin known as El Chapo, real name Joaquin Guzman. But since he was captured in 2014, for the second time, Mexican gangs have splintered and are ramping up violence, publicly executing their rivals. This is a scenario Zion sees coming to a head within the same time frame as three other major events.
That conflict is now washing up against the Mexico-California border in Tijuana, and by spring, it will be spread across the entirety of the Mexico-Texas border, just in time for the NAFTA accords to have finished their renegotiation. The Mexico drug war will be on front page news in every border community. At the same time, we enter an electoral cycle. This is the Senate map for 2018. The blues are the states where the Democrats are defending. Of the 33 states up for grabs, 25 are being defended by Democrats, and 10 of those are in states that Trump won. Now, this would guarantee that trade and Mexico and the drug war and NAFTA are all going to be election issues anyway. The real problem is this gentleman. Steve Bannon is running candidates on an anti-trade, anti-Mexico ticket against every establishment Republican running for re-election. At the same time that the region's getting really violent. And just to add one more little point of concern, you may have noticed that Trump's rhetoric tends to set Mexicans on edge. It has reformulated politics in Mexico in a decidedly anti-American direction, which means that this gentleman, Obrador, is now polling in first place. Obrador, in essence, combines the worst characteristics of Clinton on corruption, Ted Cruz on ideology, Senator Sanders on the pathological inability to do math, and Donald Trump when it comes to populism. All in one person, and he's polling first. And their election is in July. So if you had asked me 8 months ago if I thought NAFTA was in the clear, I would have said it probably is. I'd say 90% chance that we're fine. But every other factor that is in play right now has sharpened in just the last couple of months. And they're all coming to a head just as the NAFTA talks are completing next March. I didn't used to be worried about NAFTA, now I am. Now, on the backside of this, we're going to be fine, because all these other global suppliers are simply going to fall away. And no matter what color American-Mexican relations take, in the end of the day, they're our neighbors. We're going to trade in some format, and they cannot possibly feed themselves. They've got tropics, they've got desert, they've got highlands. They just can't do it. But the line from here to there is not straight, and we're probably going to get a hell of a hiccup next year this time.
Zion concluded his remarks with a PowerPoint slide labeled Global Stability Map, which showed countries considered rising stars as blue, steady states as green, and degraded states as brown. Cuba, Mexico, and the U.S. were all blue. Canada was brown. The map sparked a number of questions from the audience of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho wheat farmers, their spouses, landlords, and others associated with the industry.
Looking at the map you have up, why is Canada brown and not blue?
Okay, real quick, how many of you are from Canada?
Congratulations.
How many of you Canadians are not from the prairies? Okay, good, we can be honest. Okay, here's the problem. Canada's demography is arguably the worst in the world. They've got more people in their 60s than they have teenagers. That means that they are facing a fiscal crisis that is absolutely irrecoverable. There is one province that is an exception to that, and that's Alberta. Alberta has a demography very similar to the United States. In addition, Alberta has an oil industry, and the taxes on that oil industry are largely what fund the Canadian national budget. Because Canada is aging into obsolescence, basically, that money is what pays for all of Canada's social programs. For the last 4 years, almost five now, Alberta has been the only province that is a net payer into the Canadian national budget. Everyone else is a net taker. Secession is legal in Canada.
I'm looking at your map, mm-hmm. and I would really be interested if you overlaid on that map some of the things that we are warned about with sea level rise and large migrations and that sort of thing.
Sure.
To see how those
when you say large migrations, do you mean large migrations linked to climate change?
Well, yeah. Climate change and starvation, they kind
well,
of
yeah,
go together.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no problem.
Okay,
that
you.
Is broadly integrated in this. Here's the issue. The two things that we worry about with climate change are rising sea levels and shifting climate patterns and the way that impacts food production and livability. So let's start with the livability issue. If you move the climate bands where you can do monoculture a couple degrees north or south, you start to shift the way we grow food. So for example, you do that in Northern Europe or Eurasia, the entire wheat belt goes away, particularly in Eurasia because there's no infrastructure if you move it 2 degrees. Argentina, it's a relatively small ball, so if you move that, it's significant. All of rice in China, that just sounds weird, is in all microclimates, so a 2 degree shift is horrific. So yeah, you're talking about massive famine. And then you got the Midwest. It's a big circle. If you move it a little bit one way or the other, it's not a big deal. You might grow wheat where you grew soy or vice versa, but the United States is broadly okay. If the climate shift is enough to hit the Midwest, civilization has already ended on the rest of the planet. And you can't swim to the United States. Second, sea levels. So let's go with the worst possible forecast for the year 2100, which is about 30 feet. That would mean that New York City would need to build a seawall. They can afford it. New Orleans would have to move about 150 miles upstream, not a big problem, and we would lose Miami. Good riddance. That's it. All other American coastal communities of size are actually on small uplifts that are more than 30 feet up. So I don't mean to suggest there would be no damage. You're still talking like $10 trillion in infrastructure replacement requirements compared to $1 quadrillion in the rest of the world. Because a 30-foot raise, that's Buenos Aires, that's every coastal city in Brazil, that's the Panama Canal, that's Dhaka, that's Mumbai, that's London, that's Nice, that's not Rome, Singapore, Tianjin, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Sydney, Durban, you know, it's everybody but us. So from a national security point of view, climate change is kind of a win.
Your coloring of Cuba on the Cuba map is interesting from a wheat perspective and trade perspective.
Some flavor of normalization is going to happen. The question are the specific terms and the time scale. But as soon as you normalize relations in any meaningful way, Cuba becomes linked into the American-dominated North American industrial, agricultural, and financial space. And that gives them nowhere to go but up. So the ideology is going to shift a little bit. The politics are going to shift a little bit. But this is a country that has a workforce that is about 40% as well-skilled as Americans that works for 10% of the cost. So you can recreate the CAFTA-NAFTA miracle in Cuba easily. And for those of you in ag, this is 12 million upwardly mobile, hungry customers that are sick and tired of getting their food from a different hemisphere. American food is higher quality, it's proximate, it's cheaper. There is a small cost. The agricultural lobby across the United States is going to have to collectively backstab the sugar beet producers because you're going to have to let cane sugar into the United States as the one cost. Just like all American food is higher quality and lower cost, Cuban sugar is higher quality and lower cost than American sugar.
Do you anticipate that Asia will continue to be the primary market for the Pacific Northwest, or will that be overtaken by Australia, and we'll put our attention more to Canada, our northern neighbors?
I think your fastest growing markets are going to be Southeast Asia and Mexico, Central America. These are zones that cannot possibly feed themselves, and I expect them to be economically vibrant and growing in the years ahead. Northeast Asia, I'm pretty sure, has plateaued. Keep in mind that Australia, while they are a high-quality producer, and while they are one of six countries in the world that I think can actually expand output, the climate in Australia is incredibly arid and incredibly variable. So they can put $100 billion into infrastructure expansion and bringing new areas under till, but then the next year that they get a drought, it all just collapses. So they have booms and busts and booms and busts and booms and busts, and that's not going to change at all. For those of you who are in dairy, it's a little bit different. Do we have dairy folks here? You don't care about dairy. Never mind. Yeah. Yeah, the only other grain producers that might be a concern for you are two of the other countries of those six, and that's France and Argentina. Both of them are going to be expanding output, but not nearly as much as what you guys can do.
I was wondering about the energy supply and the effort to diversify the resources, whether it be coal, wind, solar, and even the small nuclear reactors that are being proposed, and how
sure.
that might soften an instability across the U.S. as well as the
sure.
world.
The United States is the only first world country that's close enough to the equator to actually use solar in any meaningful way, and we can really only use it in a belt from Central California to Central Texas. Anywhere outside of that zone, you're probably actually increasing your carbon footprint by putting in solar because you can't turn off your conventional generation. Now, for some of you in the Pac Northwest, if you're in a place that gets hydro, you might be a partial exception, although I would definitely in this area go with wind over solar. I mean, I'm sorry, the sun just doesn't shine here all that often. Coal, the only way that coal is going to stay in the fuel mix, because it's competing with that free natural gas, it just can't on price. So the only way coal is going to stick around at all is if we get a regulation that mandates a certain backup capacity. And because a pile of coal isn't going to go anywhere, coal can qualify in those grounds, so can nuclear. But remember, with nuclear, most Americans now don't want it. As much as they don't like coal, they hate nuclear more. So we have two, as of a year ago, we had four nuclear power plants in this country under construction, the first one since the 70s. Two of those have since been canceled, and the other two are up in the air. And even if those two get built, they're the last ones that'll ever get built, because we just don't want them as a people. Now, whether or not that's wise or not is a whole different topic. But the trick with alternatives moving forward is, because they're so intermittent, you have to pair them with another fuel source. Technically, you can do that with nukes. But whenever a power plant goes from 2 to 100% in less than a couple of minutes, the NRC gets really nervous, because it looks a lot like meltdown. So we're not going to use nukes for that. Coal plants take 36 hours to spin up and down, so that can't work. That just leaves natural gas. A combined cycle natural gas plant can spin up in 10 to 15 minutes, and you can pair that with the intermittency of solar and wind. So that's probably the only fuel that we're going to be using in the future in volume. The one possible exception is that the new wind towers are 80 meters tall, not 30, 80, so 250 feet. And they tap stronger and more reliable wind currents in a broader geographic scope. So we'll probably, 15 years from now, be using wind for about 20 to 25% of national power needs, which is great. But natural gas will have everything else.
One more question right here.
Can you speak to the TPP-11's ability to move forward with the agreement and also be successful with the agreement without the United States being involved?
Sure. I never thought that TPP-12 was going to get ratified. The Obama administration didn't put its back into it, never courted the business community, didn't try to sell it to Congress. It just was never going to happen. Also, if you want to get a free trade deal, you don't invite Japan, because Japan doesn't have a single free trade deal with anyone. They smash free trade deals. They want bilateral understandings and nothing more. So the whole Obama process for TPP-12 was really doomed from the start. TPP-11 won't happen, because what encouraged most countries that had not really engaged in the free trade world, places like Vietnam and Indonesia, for example, what encouraged them to join was access to the American market. If they can't get that, they don't want the rest of it. Now, I firmly believe that at some point in the not-too-distant future, maybe even under Trump, we will get a new TPP agreement. The hilarious thing about TPP is that Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, has taken TPP and used 90% of it as the framework for future bilateral deals.
It's a crazy, complicated world beyond the farming fields of the Pacific Northwest, and I'm glad people like Peter Zion are thinking seriously about it. One of the problems with prognosticators, however, is that it's rare anyone goes back to see whether their predictions were accurate. What I took away from Zion's presentation is that for all of our inadequacies and challenges as a nation, our geographical, agricultural, political, and military advantages will hold us in good stead for years into the future. That's all the time we have. I hope you have enjoyed episode 55. Hold on tight. The World According to Peter Zion continued. A global strategist who spoke at the 2017 Tri-State Grain Growers Convention in Spokane on November 10th. Please tell your friends about this podcast and join me again next time for another episode of Weed All About It.
Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chilling. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You want to be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.